from taking my son into the comic shop.
Why?
She doesn't want him to turn into
a geek.
Like the guy behind the comic book store.
Wow.
I think this
is almost a guarantee that's what will happen.
I know, it's almost like by
Just think of the Simpsons guy.
Yeah, that's it.
Worst wife ever.
I wasted my life.
They are like comics book guy from The Simpsons, the guy in this particular comic book.
Brighton has got some comic shops. Not mention where it is, Andy.
Maybe I'll walk down the street.
A city on the south coast.
Yeah. Well, I am obviously ignoring my wife's advice as I'm going and taking her in there every Saturday.
Winning, like, favourite dad award every single time.
As I take a stroll through the redacted with my redacted to go shopping for.
Right. Shall we kick off? Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. As usual, we're gathered around a table in the offices of Unbound, the publishers who bring authors and readers together. But guess what? It's not the usual table. It's a new table in a new canal side office. Anyway, that's the reason it sounds different, if it in fact sounds different. I'm John Mitchinson, publisher at Unbound.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And joining us today, as usual, is the author and comics fan, Matthew Clayton. Hello, Matthew.
Hello, everyone.
And also the writer, critic, and lecturer, Lucy Scholes. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, everyone.
Thanks very much for coming in. You are here for a very specific reason, which John will now reveal.
Very well read.
Yeah.
Off the script. You're joining us today for a specific reason, which is to discuss the book, The Vet's Daughter by Barbara Cummings.
Yes, have we got that right?
Yes.
It's spelled Cummins, but it's pronounced Cummings.
I think that was how I was told to pronounce it. I'm doing it wrong. Barbara's granddaughter. So I think we should take that as fact.
And we should say the specific reason, or one excellent reason why Lucy is here, is that it is fair to say, and factually accurate to say, that you are a Barbara Cummings expert.
In as far as Warden can be an expert on an author about whom not much is known, but I guess so, yes.
Not much is known, but in a way I feel, well, we'll come on to it later. I feel I know more than I know about a lot of people.
Well, I feel as I'd say at the top straight away that Lucy has written an absolutely brilliant essay, which is probably the longest biographical thing available about Barbara Cummings, called The Writer Lost in Time, and that's on the Emily Books website, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I think it is the longest piece out there, definitely, because so little is sort of in the public realm about her.
Have you got any rivals as the Barbara Cummings expert?
After today, maybe that'll come out of the woodwork. I think there was somebody else doing some research. I was told that a while ago, but they, as far as I'm aware, they didn't publish anything or do anything with it. So I'm perhaps not the first person to look into it, but the first one who's written about her.
And definitely the best.
If that's what you want to say.
Before we get to Barbara Cummings and her extraordinary oeuvre, it is the usual form on these podcasts that I say to you, Andy, what have you been reading?
Well, John, thanks for asking. There's two things I'm going to talk about this time. I've been finishing off the book I mentioned on the last podcast, Eternal Troubadour, The Improbable Life of Tiny Tim by Justin Martel with Alanna Ray MacDonald. The most brilliant and miserable book I have ever read about what it is like to be in show business. And I have talked about this book.
And you've read some miserable showbiz memoirs.
I've read A Little Goes a Long Way by Sid Little.
Crikey.
Which I've got a signed copy of it, which cost me 1p.
Was it you that sent that remarkable picture of the topless Sid, Little and Large, that was doing the rounds on Twitter?
It wasn't me, but it's almost a meme.
It's proto-meme.
Anyway, so I've talked about the book quite a lot. I just wanted to read that just very near the end of this book, there is one tiny story which made me laugh out loud. Anyone who has ever been a member of a band will recognise this as the decision-making process of any band or artistic endeavour, okay? We were all very happy with the way it turned out, Burnett concluded. We wanted to help Tiny make something that would stand as a real album. At first, the album was to be called Back to Normality, after a line taken from Tiny's ad-libbed monologue during Sly Cigarette. However, the title Back to Normality was scrapped after a debate over whether or not normality was a word. That seems to me to be... It's such a wonderful book. I cannot recommend that highly enough. So I finished that book. The other book that I've been reading, I mentioned on the last podcast that thanks to the magic of an interlibrary loan, I was able to read Haldor Laxness's novel Salkavalka, which has been out of print in this country for the last 50 years. I also ordered another couple of books at the same time. One of those was Sheila Delaney's only book of short stories, Sheila Delaney, who wrote A Taste of Honey, called Sweetly Sings the Donkey, and that's terrific. Quite hard to buy a copy of that, but got a copy from the reserve stock at Swiss Cottage Library, thank you. But the other book that I read was called First Signs by the late Barry Hines. Now, we talked about Barry Hines after he died earlier this year. We talked about him on the podcast, and I was asking why it was that his book, A Kestrel for a Knave, later filmed as Kes, was still so widely read and so popular, and yet how few of his other books seem to be widely read or popular. Because when he died, I did the thing that people do and I do, which is go online and say, oh, I'd like to read something by Barry Hines. Almost nothing is available, except A Kestrel for a Knave. So I did a bit of research, and I found that A Kestrel for a Knave, I think, is published in 67 or 68. It's filmed in 1970. It's a bestseller. And his next novel is this book, First Signs. I could not find a copy of First Signs. So I ordered it from the library. A second-hand copy would cost you about £100. I never made it into paperback. So I was thinking, well, why would that... That seems really strange that a novel by a best-selling author, which is published at
the softy southern critics.
That might be one explanation. So I order this book for the library. I've just read Salkavalka by Haldor Laxness, incredible book. I've just read Sweetly Sings the Donkey by Sheila Delaney, incredible, sort of poignant, and sort of Sheila never really had the full writing career she could have had. So, but that was great too. And then I'm coming into First Signs by Barry Hines. Here I go. It is terrible. Now, I'm not saying that Barry Hines is a terrible author. He clearly isn't. He's clearly a brilliant author. He had a brilliant career, a fantastic track record. This is not me having a pop at the legacy of Barry Hines. I am fascinated to understand why this particular novel was published in this form and then never published again. And I'm going to... Well, you can't see this, everybody, but I'm going to hold up the cover now and show it to the table.
Audible gasps.
Oh, my word.
Okay, that's...
Is that pubic hair on the cover?
It is. It's a full frontal painting of a naked lady, but instead of a head, she's got...
A pit head.
That kind of looks like some kind of weird Magritte pastiche.
Yeah. And the plant pot just in front of her.
Aspidistra, maybe.
Well, it's a book of two halves. So this painting is an accurate representation.
The lining and the...
Yes. The first half of the book is about naked ladies, and the second half of the book is about Pit Village.
Really?
It's such a strange book. And so I read some more about Barry Hines, and Barry Hines...
Is that not the best author picture?
We'll put the author picture up as well. There's no blurb on this book.
It says the author of Kes, but that seems a little... I mean, the book was actually called A Kestrel for a Knave.
No, be fair. Yeah. He has written two previous novels, The Blinder and A Kestrel for a Knave, okay, which were successfully filmed as Kes.
It says on the front, Kes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it does say author of Kes.
So Barry Hines, it says on the back, the son of a miner... is a schoolmaster in Yorkshire, and this is about the son of a miner who goes to Spain.
Published by Michael Joseph.
Has romantic adventures with a lot of naked ladies. Amazing. And comes back to his pit village. Now, I was reading about Barry Hines. Barry Hines was very left-wing. And initially, I was reading the book, and I was thinking, well, this book is... What's wrong with this book is it's no good. It's really poorly structured.
It's
poorly structured. The prose isn't very good. There's no plot. Nothing happens. There's no emotional development, there's no intellectual development. But then I realised that Barry Hines had worked with Ken Loach a lot. And I thought, maybe this book isn't no good. Maybe it's very left-wing. Maybe, because if you're very left-wing...
Sort of Brechtian alienation.
Yes, exactly.
It makes you feel that
plot is bourgeois.
Yeah.
Therefore, plot must be rejected.
Identifying with characters, bourgeois.
Yes.
Oh, don't like any
yes,
of that.
Yes, 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 but that's exactly the problem with the book.
Fact, fiction itself is the ultimate bourgeois form. So this is like a minus finger being jabbed in your eye repeatedly.
It is exactly
reminding
like that.
You of the realities of life.
It's like a long straight line which stops after 200 pages. But I was thinking this in regard to... I wrote about The Ragged Trouser Philanthropist by Robert Tressel.
Which is a good novel.
Similarly, though, rejects many of the bourgeois tropes of the novel by being deliberately repetitive and massively overlong. Yeah. The theory being that it recreates the grind of capitalist employment and does not give you any...
in the life of the reader.
Yeah, I think it does not give you any sort of compromised romantic way out. So I would genuinely like, if you have read, in the unlikely event that you've read First Signs by Barry Hines, or that you know anything about it, or why it never made it into paperback, please email me or tweet me. I would be fascinated to discover what.
Sounds to me it didn't make it into paperback because it wasn't very good.
Yeah, but you know what? You know what, John? This is a serious point.
Yeah, it is.
That it's a mucky book by a successful writer coming off the back of a successful film. It seems bizarre, even if it's not very good, that it wouldn't make it into paperback.
That is odd. I mean, the only one I can think of that we've thought about recently was the Bratby book. I don't think that made it into paperback.
It did.
Oh, it did. Yeah. Breakdown did make it into paperback.
Yeah. The one that just didn't stay
in print.
David Miller gave me the example of the agent and writer David Miller gave me the example of Something Happened by Joseph Heller, which was the follow-up to Catch 22. What was a disaster at the time.
Oh,
and
maybe they just
didn't make it into paper.
As in this case, having had Kestrel for a name, they suddenly decided to bury it because it was going to do his career more harm than good.
Well, someone said to me, perhaps Barry Hines didn't think it was any good.
Yeah.
Perhaps he had to write it out, get it out, and then...
Because there are other novels of his.
The Gamekeeper, which I think is a very good novel. Yeah, he has a very successful career. As I say, what's still slightly mystifying is that there's only one book of his in print, and that's A Kestrel for a Name.
You don't think he wrote that first and then tried to publish it after based on the success of Kestrel?
That is a very good theory. It does have a bit of a juvenile autobiography.
It's very autobiographical.
Yeah, because if you say that, and also it's just not actually
the mystery,
that great.
The mystery deepens.
Didn't Alan Sillitoe move to Mallorca, didn't he, after his first success?
Did he?
Mm-hmm. I met him once actually at a party, and I said, well, you know, why did you move to Mallorca? And he was like, well,
have you seen where I live?
They want to stick around in Nottingham. I was like, I moved to Mallorca and I write about Nottingham from there. And I was like, well, that's very sensible.
Just like Joyce.
Nice to meet you.
Dublin from.
Anyway, Joy.
Okay, what have I been reading?
John, what have you been reading?
Well, I've been reading a novel by Ian Maguire called The North Water. And why have I been reading it? Two reasons. I was struck, as anyone on the QI series will tell you, I'm the whale guy. I'm mildly obsessed with cetaceans. Cool. And I like the whole, not just the actual animals themselves, although they're interesting enough, but the whole 19th century whaling. Just one of these most, I mean, unthinkable, kind of brutal, difficult businesses. And the whole idea that we ran factories and, you know, lit our homes with the oil all extracted from these extraordinary animals. So I'm already in the zone. It struck me also that there was a book published last year called Russia, which I didn't read, which was about whaling. But I looked at this, and it also on the cover there was a quote from Hilary Mantel and a quote from Martin Amis.
Yes.
I very, very rarely get Indeed. Martin Amis giving a book a quote. So I read it in reasonably high hopes. I really did think it was an extraordinary book. And it's had very good reviews. It had a great review from Colm Tobin, which I might just read a little line from, because this seems to me to get it exactly right. The North Water feels like the result of an encounter between Joseph Conrad and Cormac McCarthy in some rundown port as they offer each other a long, sour nod of recognition. I mean, this book is dark, grimy. It starts with... It starts with a very unsavoury character, a harpooner called Henry Drax, who within the first 10 pages has basically raped and murdered a young boy, 10-year-old, 12-year-old boy. It oozes every single... I mean, it's cold. They go on... Drax is a harpooner on a ship. They leave Hull. They sail for the North Water. You assume they're going to kill whales. In fact, it's an elaborate insurance fraud. The other main character in the book is Patrick Sumner, who's an Irish surgeon who has, we discover, been disgracefully kind of excluded from the army. So he's running away, taking opium in order to forget, the shame of his past life. The classic setup, they all find themselves on this boat. The boat ends up kind of sinking. They then find themselves on the ice. There are polar bears. There are disgraceful scenes of eating seal, the squishing of a seal's eyeball in your mouth when you're eating. It's cold, it's dark, it's full of blood, semen,
all the fluids.
In fact, fecal seepage is a phrase that's used in the... everything smells bad. It's everything turns bad.
The Martin Amis, Hilary Mantel, and a quote from what you've just said is going on the paperback.
And the thing is, what I love about it, I mean, I have a few quibbles. The use of what seems to me to be 20th century sort of slang, using the F word a lot.
Yeah.
Just slightly kind of... but in general, what you don't get, which is there's not lots of long descriptions of, he's not trying to write a historical novel to impress you in that Palliser way about how fully he... I mean, he obviously knows there's lots of fabulously gruesome scenes of what they have to do to the whales, flensing, and there's this wonderful thing, the stuff that they throw in the water is called krang. I mean, a lot of this stuff, unless you're really interested in whaling, you can take or leave. But what I like about it is that the two main characters, you can sense that there isn't... there is an extraordinary and terrible resolution to the book. But he doesn't... It's sort of like a meditation on how might you write about... Which I think is why Hilary Mantel likes it. So how do you write about the past without making it seem like, that kind of... BBC adaptation didn't they get dresses right? I mean, it's a really strong... Cormac McCarthy's probably the closest.
Have you read HHHH or Ash by Laurent Binet?
No.
It's about the Heydrich assassination plot in Prague, have I got that right? And it's sort of Robert Ludlum for TLS readers. I mean, it's sort of a gripping account of the capture of the men who assassinated Heydrich, and also amusing on how you put it into fiction without at some level betraying the memory of the actual bravery of the men who performed that act. It's funny when you said you were reading this book, because the publisher sent me a copy maybe 6 months ago.
It's Scribner, isn't it?
Yeah, and I saw exactly like you. I read the Martin Amis quotes and Hilary Mantel quotes, and thought, someone knows someone.
Maguire teaches at Manchester, so I'm figuring that.
But also, they wouldn't give the quotes unless the book was good. Yeah. Right? So,
and you got Colin Tobin, Hilary Mantel, and Martin Amis. Then your interest is piqued.
But I've seen people talking about it. It feels to me, this feels like this is going to be a big book. I see people talking about it already. And actually, when you told me you were reading it, I picked it up and I read the first 4 or 5 pages and put it down and thought, this is going to be massive.
I think the thing about it is that it could be all kinds of... It could be Sacred Hunger by Barry Unsworth, but it kind of isn't.
Yeah.
It's very, very taut. He's not trying to make big geopolitical kind of parallels. He's taking a group of characters, putting them in. I mean, if you ever want to know what it feels like to spend a night inside the carcass of a polar bear that you've just killed, it is blood-soaked.
Yeah.
Without being in any kind of... We'll come on to Gothic, but I mean, it's not really a Gothic novel. It has elements of that, but it's too good for that. And his characters, I think, are too... there are no... There are no easy morals from it. I have to say, I was gripped, and I think like you, it will probably do when, you know, gongs are handed out later in the year. I'd be surprised if it wasn't.
I really want to read it, I must say. Just based on those 3 or 4 pages, I thought I must find the time to read this.
We've got to talk about other things, but the prose is faultless. I mean, it's really, and some of the passages are just. There's a somewhere he talks about a newish saw that he's got in his bag, and some of the reviews said it's the word newish that really a newish bone saw. And he said newish that's really upsetting. Which actually, fine, you never know that you're going to do these things, but that kind of precision of the unheimlich detail, you know, the very odd detail, is very, very Barbara Cummings.
What is that book? What is that book and author called again, please?
It's called The North Water, Ian Maguire.
Yeah, so given the choice, everyone, between The North Water by Ian Maguire and First Signs by Barry Hines, you won't be able to get hold of a copy of First Signs, as luck would have it. So we recommend The North Shore.
We'll pick this up again after some marvellously witty and interesting adverts.
Lucy.
Yes.
Barbara Cummings. I first read a Barbara Cummings book at the start of this year, and I really liked it. It's her second novel. It's called Our Spoons Came from Woolworths. Mm-hmm. And I really liked it. It seems popular, you know. But then I read this book, The Vet's Daughter, and I was completely blown away by it. Mm. And I've read a couple more Barbara Cummings since then, and I think Barbara Cummings is amongst my new favourite authors. Where did you first encounter her, and when?
I think I read Spoons first as well, and I think it was quite a long time ago. It was about 10, maybe 15 years ago now, when I was reading a lot of mid-century kind of women writers. I think I probably found a copy in a university library or something, and I read it, and I really liked it, but I didn't connect it with a kind of larger body of work or anything like that. And I think because Spoons is probably one of the novels that has remained more well-known and potentially kind of more in print on a regular basis. Mm. And then I think it was maybe 2 or 3 years ago, Virago in this country republished Spoons, Vet's Daughter, and Sisters by a River, her first novel. And I got sent 3 for review, and I read them all, and I just loved them. And Spoons was incredibly different to how I'd remembered it first time round, which was sort of weird and sort of shocked me and made me sort of distrust my own recollection of what I had read before. But then also you then read The Vet's Daughter and even Sisters by a River, and she's doing something really different as well. Mm. And I think that most people know, if anyone knows about her, they tend to know Spoons, and actually The Vet's Daughter, I think, is a far more interesting novel, as I think we all...
It's completely, I think, captivating novel and so strange and so original. It's very short, but it feels it's so much detail packed into it. There's so many remarkable lines in it, so the psychology. It's first person, and the voice seems to me to have that kind of come from the first paragraph. That authority of a David Copperfield or a Pip or anyone or a Holden Caulfield. I mean, it's a very original voice, but also so weirdly childlike and kind of. I mean, I'm blown away, and also added to the pile of really, really remarkable writers who I had not even heard of before we started doing this podcast.
One of the things I found with reading Our Spoons Came from Woolworths is that I couldn't shake off the sense when I was reading it that I was reading something. I've seen this term applied to Barbara Cummings, I found very interesting. I couldn't shake the sense that it was in some way outsider art, that I couldn't tell how much craft there was in it. Yeah. It seemed like someone with a very distinctive voice, which might be accidental, right? But then when I read The Vet's Daughter, one of the reasons I read it so quickly is I felt I needed to read another one to get more of a sense of the artistry of it. And the control in The Vet's Daughter is absolutely remarkable, I think, in terms of the steeliness with which the narrative is laid out, leading to an ending which, I was saying before we started recording, I think is my favourite. We're not going to say what it is, everybody, don't worry, but I think it's my favourite ending of any book that we've read so far for Backlisted.
I'd go for that.
It's high praise.
Well, you know, it's just...
It is an amazing ending, and I think it packs such a huge punch, and one that you're not expecting at all. I mean, you know, the novel prepares you in certain ways for things that are going to happen, but when you first read that, I mean, I was taken aback as well by it. It's really, really.
It's the punch is not pulled.
Yeah.
But I feel the punch is not pulled anywhere through the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, she doesn't let Alice off the hook. At any point. You realise that's quite rare in fiction, that there are brief moments when she's lying, she ends up, I guess it must be the Isle of Purbeck or somewhere that she's...
I think it's Hayling Island.
Hayling Island, is it? Because she can see the Isle of Wight at one point. Yeah, I'm just trying to work out where it was. But then she gets to lie in the caravan and sort of for the first time.
Sorry, I think we've got a canal boat going past.
And it's an airplane. I thought you were spoiler alert. It's only lying in the caravan. Right? But
don't want to take that line again. Lying in the caravan.
I was just lying in the caravan and musing and eating sort of stolen apples. I mean, no book I've read recently do small pleasures, small tiny. Let's be honest, mm-hmm. tiny pleasures count for more. I mean, the bleakness of the life, the cabbage smelling house, the mother, yeah. the brutal father.
The father.
It just gets worse and worse and worse. But she's indomitable, isn't she? She's got this kind of incredible sort of resistance that she just won't... That she won't give in.
I'm literally
floats above.
I just want to give people. I think we should tell people. Yeah. Normally, what we do on Backlisted, as you know, is we read the blurb on the back of the book. The current edition of The Vet's Daughter has no blurb on it. It has three quotes from Sarah Waters, Alan Hollinghurst, and Graham Greene.
Pretty good,
Graham Greene, who loved this book.
Yeah,
and we're going to come on to that. He says the strange, offbeat talent of Miss Cummings, and that innocent eye which observes with childlike simplicity the most fantastic or the most ominous occurrence. These have never, I think, been more impressively exercised than in The Vet's Daughter. But I did find another blurb, and here it is. It's from a review in The Guardian in 2013. The Vet's Daughter, a masterly example of suburban Gothic meets magical realism. Set in the Clapham Battersea borders, at the turn of the century, the novel tells the strange, sad story of Alice Rowlands and her vicious father. He puts down his cancer-ridden wife like an animal while selling the creatures brought to him for the same reason to the vivisectionist. Oh. There's a neurotic parrot locked in the lavatory and a, quote, partly cooked, unquote, cat. After a particularly traumatic episode in her young life, Alice discovers she can levitate. A fact that, once discovered by her father, leads to a ghoulish, violent denouement on Clapham Common. That is an excellent blurb.
It is.
Written by our guest.
Ah. I thought I recognised it when you started reading.
I mean, the magical realism element is what's remarkable, the way she manages that. Who knew that this... I mean, there was a magical realist writer.
Well, this writing, is the thing, she's writing so much earlier than something Angela Carter. Because I think people...
Angela Carter is the one.
She's a bit like Angela Carter, but she was writing so much earlier than that. And the way that she uses the magical realism is incredibly advanced for the time that she was writing, I think. So I find it really strange that that she's not so well known.
I mean, it's the other book that it reminded me a lot of, and one we've done on the podcast, was Lolly Willows, where there was a similar kind of, you know, it suddenly starts as one kind of realist narrative and turns into something else.
We've talked about this before, but certainly with Barbara Cummings and the books of hers that I've now read, she has a unique combination of the quaint and the nightmarish. That things seem to be pootling along in quite a safe and reasonable way, and will suddenly veer horribly with horrible realism into some terrible scenario of violence. This all suppressed violence in it all the time as well.
Or not so suppressed. About the mother being... The mother having to take the father... I mean, that relationship, the fact that he kind of basically buys her for £100 from or the parents pay £100 so he marries her, and then he treats her brutally from the beginning, and she has to take his boots off every evening, and one night he flies into a rage and kicks her so hard in her mouth he breaks her teeth, and that, the there are times in the book where she comes back and she's obsessed with broken teeth, and you know, when she goes through her, I mean, I suppose we can say that she gets raped in the
mm-hmm.
the most extraordinary description, accurate but awful description of rape I've ever read.
Does she actually get raped?
I don't know.
I think she's.
Do you think she's not?
Because you remember when afterwards the friendly woman who helps around the house says that you're still a good girl, don't worry. So I think that it falls short of rape.
Excellent. Yes.
But she says that they're entwined.
What she says is we were linked. He dragged me to the floor and we were linked together.
Yeah.
Which is ambiguous and unpleasant. And she does also say that she felt she'd never be clean again.
Yeah, that's true. I think you read it as a rape, and then you think. Yeah. Then I always think afterwards.
After the rape that she has her first.
Well, that's the thing. It's the first traumatic event that leads to.
Lucy, could you read? I know you were going to read something from the start of the novel. Could you just read us that little bit you were going to read, just to give people
at the beginning?
Yeah, the flavour of the. Of her voice, of Barbara Cummings' voice.
Okay, so this is the beginning of the first chapter. A man with small eyes and a ginger moustache came and spoke to me when I was thinking of something else. Together we walked down a street that was lined with privet hedges. He told me that his wife belonged to the Plymouth Brethren, and I said I was sorry because that is what he seemed to need me to say, and I saw he was a poor, broken-down sort of creature. If he had been a horse, he would most likely have worn kneecaps. We came to a great red railway arch that crossed the road like a heavy rainbow, and near the arch there was a vet's house with a lamp outside. I said, "You must excuse me," and left this poor man among the privet hedges. I entered the house. It was my home, and it smelt of animals, although there was lino on the floor. In the brown hall, my mother was standing, and she looked at me with her sad eyes half covered by their heavy lids, but did not speak. She just stood there. Her bones were small and her shoulders sloped. Her teeth were not straight either. So if she had been a dog, my father would have destroyed her.
Oh, God.
I said, "Mother, I smell cabbage. It must be lunchtime."
One of the great, really terrible lines in all literature. The smell of cabbage pervades, isn't it? It's brilliant.
Yeah, the whole house is. And then they have their lunch, and then.
The clacking plates.
The clacking plates, and there is a. There's this bit here. The dining room was dark because a dirty holly tree came close to the window. You could not have told it was summer, except that the fire grate was filled with pleated paper with soot on it. Before the fireplace was a rug made of skinned Great Dane dog. And on the carved mantelpiece there was a monkey's skull with a double set of teeth which seemed to chatter when you looked at them. After lunch, I helped Mother in the kitchen. Through the window, I could see the sun shining on houses, so I asked Mother if I could walk in the park with my friend Lucy. As usual, she told me to ask Father, so I went to the surgery. The door was propped open by a horse's hoof without a horse joined to it. He was sewing in a peak's eye. He used chloroform, but I went away because I couldn't bear to see him sewing a dog like that. The smell of chloroform seemed to go with me even when I met my friend.
So brilliant and so spare.
I know, but the point is, it's the details that appear to be sort of slight, almost like non sequiturs. You know, where you're not sure where she's taking the story. I think it's brilliant.
But also
brilliant,
all those weird disassociated images of, you know, the horse's foot without the horse attached to it and the peak's eye. It's this kind of weird sort of Frankenstein-like house of horrors is being set up.
Yeah.
And the way that she sees it in that sort of slightly, like you say, it's all these kind of disassociated images that together make this kind of horrible, horrible whole.
So should we say a bit about who Barbara Cummings was then? She was born in 1907, one of six children, grew up on the banks of the Avon River in a house called Bell Court. That is the basis of her first novel, Sisters by a River.
Yeah.
She went to art school, married the artist John Pemberton, both exhibited work with the London Group of Artists in 1934. They knew Dylan Thomas and Augustus John. So they were connected, but the marriage broke down in 1935, and that is the basis for the novel of Our Spoons Came from Woolworths. And there is, Our Spoons Came from Woolworths, described by Dr. Matthew Sweet as such an authentic world of grim boho poverty.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's quite as good a novel as The Vet's Daughter, but it's also very memorable.
Although I really enjoyed reading it, and I think, yeah, that...
And what, Lucy, there's a note, isn't there, at the beginning of Our Spoons Came From Woolworths?
Yeah. It just says, so it's on the imprint page, and it says, the only things that are true in this story are the wedding and chapters 10, 11 and 12 and the poverty.
How wonderful.
Which is basically the entire novel.
Yeah.
Because the novel is infused with poverty. I mean, poverty is at the heart of it. It's the reason that everything in their marriage breaks down. It's the reason that they're unhappy. It's kind of so... It's such an odd note, isn't it? Because it's both acknowledging it, but also not acknowledging it at the same time.
It's also so interesting that that is now her best-known novel.
Mm.
That it's the one that's been most recently serialised on the radio.
Yeah.
It gets chosen for book groups.
Yeah.
Quite regularly as well. And it is a very good book, but it's that autobiographical element seems to be...
I think
the thing
people
that
like
people
that.
Glom onto, yeah.
Well, also, I think, I mean, maybe it's worth mentioning chapters 10, 11 and 12 are the ones in the novel that feature the protagonist, Sophia, giving birth to her first child. And it is told in quite a level of detail, which is unexpected for today, let alone when she's writing it. So, and I think a lot of the more recent sort of readers and people who've been championing Spoons have picked up on that and saying that it's really... It's, you know, it's revelatory in that sense that she was writing so honestly about childbirth. Yeah. So there's something, you know, there as well.
So in the late 1930s, Cummings begins a relationship with a black marketeer called Arthur Price. And I'm quoting Wikipedia here, everybody. Cummings generated money by breeding poodles, renovating pianos, dealing in antiques and classic cars.
The Gondas, I love it.
And drawing for commercial advertisements, which she once again, this is the pattern,
yeah.
All of which appears in the later novel, Mr. Fox.
Yeah,
right?
Mr. Fox is based on that period in her life.
And then she remarries in 1945 to a... she's still connected to a friend and colleague of Kim Philby.
Yeah.
And so she has this sort of second act in terms of she's out of poverty, but she's writing a isn't she?
No, she's not out of poverty.
Tell me more.
Well, no, I mean, just when she met Richard Cummings Carr, he was working in Whitehall, and that's where he knew Philby from. But he left his job in Whitehall. Supposedly, he was fired due to his links with Philby. So there's a bit of a story there that's not quite clear. And then they moved after that. They were in a lot of financial problems. They moved to Spain and lived there for many years. And one of the books she wrote while out in Spain is called Out of the Red, Into the Blue, which is probably the closest, although lots of her novels are based on things that happened to her, it's actually much more of a memoir. And it begins, I think, on the very first page or the second page. There's a wonderful line where she says something like, you know, my husband, we've only got one peseta left, we don't know what to do. I told my husband to write to the bank, maybe there's just no money in the account. And they lived in Spain on this terrible...
Living in Ibiza, didn't they?
Yeah, they lived in Ibiza for a while, Barcelona, and then some, I can't remember the other, they sort of lived all around for a long time. But they were really poverty stricken out there. I think the poverty did haunt her for most of her life. And if you read her diaries from the later years, which I've been lucky to have some access to, again, she's writing about money a lot, or needing money and not being able to get money.
So she writes, her first novel, Sisters by a River, is published in 1947. And she publishes 8 novels in the next 20 years. She's publishing regularly, right? So she, Sisters by a River, Our Spoons Came from Woolworths, Who Was Changed and Who Was Dead in 1954, this novel, The Vet's Daughter, in 1959, Out of the Red and Into the Blue, 60, The Skin Chairs, which we'll also say a little bit about in a minute, in 1960, I mean The Skin Chairs, everyone, in 1962. Birds in Tiny Cages, is that a novel? Or a...
That is a novel, but that's the one set in Spain.
Yeah, 64, and then Touch of Mistletoe in 1967, and then she doesn't publish anything for...
It's
20 about, years.
I don't think it's quite 20 years. The next one is kind of in the 80s.
85.
Yeah.
Juniper Tree in 85. So what... Is she well known at the time? She has the patronage of Graham Greene.
I think Graham Greene liked The Vet's Daughter. I mean, I think she did get some good reviews for some of the earlier stuff. Again...
The Vet's Daughter did get good reviews.
Yeah, that got quite interesting reviews. But I think that she doesn't publish for a while, but... something like The House of Dolls, for example, which is her final novel, not published till 89, she was writing that as early as 67 or 69, something like that, because there's accounts in her diaries of her writing this. So I don't know. I'm not entirely sure what meant that she wasn't publishing. Perhaps it was the fact she was out of the country, focusing on other things at that time.
It might be one of those cases, as with Barbara Pym, that Barbara Pym, you know, can't get published from the early 1960s onwards, and it's only in the mid 70s when she is named as one of the greatest living writers by both Philip Larkin and somebody else that the publishers turn around and say, "Have you got anything?" Got anything?
Yeah.
So she then publishes the novels in her later career are the books that she'd been writing while she couldn't get published.
That's true, but I think also, The House of Dolls is not a particularly accomplished novel compared to her earlier ones, and neither is. I mean, Mr. Fox is fun. It's a bit more like Spoons, I guess, but it doesn't do some of the more interesting things that Vet's Daughter, Skin Chairs, even The Juniper Tree, which comes before Mr. Fox, does.
Yeah.
So there's, I don't know, I feel with her there's this kind of two strands in her work. One that is much more kind of straightforward, autobiographical, weaving in these kind of, you know, things that happened to her. And she did live a fascinating life, so that, you know, it's great to read about. But then there's this other strand of this kind of weird magical realism, sort of suburban gothic, strange things that are happening, and that kind of that mixture of comedy and tragedy and sort of real horror as well.
Almost Stella Gibbons-like in places.
Yeah, which you just don't expect when you read her other stuff. So I think that it's... I don't know, I haven't quite worked out how you reconcile those two
why
sides
is it,
of that.
It's, going back to The Vet's Daughter, why is it Levitation, do you think, is she picks as being the particular characteristic that the main character develops?
That's interesting. I never even...
It kind of works, because it's just that thing. It's, you feel it's like...
It's like mesmerism,
or the accounts of you know, kind of
something appropriate to the era.
Something weird, Victorian,
you know,
isn't
Enfield
it?
Enfield haunting. It's that kind of
I think
thing.
It has that. It's got that sort of gothic-y Victorian feel to it.
The unhappiness is almost so kind of concentrated in her that she kind of almost the only thing she can do, and it's like, well, without giving away the ending at all. I mean, it is just remarkable, and I it becomes a sort of a something that she. It's one of the few things that she can take pride in.
But also there's something there, because she goes into that sort of weird trance when she does it. And I think there's something to be said there about disassociation, which is why it also links in with... if you look at it quite carefully, all the episodes of Levitation, before she manages to master it as a sort of skill she can do on demand, they all occur after some kind of traumatic event in her life.
Yeah.
And so it's like... a sort of dissociative skill, isn't it?
So it's psychologically consistent.
Yeah, I think so.
Setting for this book is remarkable.
Yeah. That's the thing, isn't it? Because no one's really theorising this when she's writing it. That's, I think, what's most intriguing, that actually when you work it through, there's a really, you know, if this has been written today, you'd say, well, someone's read a bit of Freud, they know, they can, you know, work it out. But, you know, well, not even Freud, obviously, but, you know, someone's read some kind of, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. There's a lot of theorising goes on in the 80s or whatever. This is written so much earlier, so it's quite...
She also has this brilliant... The passage you just read has that lovely switch in and out of humour.
Yeah.
That I just want to read a bit from quite late in the book. Very short. It became almost dark in the big room, except for the glow from the fire, and I longed to draw the curtains and make it light. I thought I could see a tall brass lamp gleaming, and on the mantelpiece there were candles waiting to be lit. The vague, sad voice went on and on, quote, "My husband was still alive when the house was almost gutted by fire. I'll never forget old Floss howling, but we couldn't reach her. There we were, trapped in this very room, and smoke pouring under the door. Henry was safe in the next room, but poor old Floss died, and the little maid we had then, I believe her name was Alice, too. Her charred body was found crouching on the landing. I thought she'd be black like burnt paper. She was a dreadful reddish brown. Poor girl. I sometimes think the fire was the cause of my trouble." On and on she went. I'd have been interested if I hadn't been so hungry and tired. I mean...
I know. The thing is, it's I'm going to read it a little bit in a moment as well, but it's that precision, isn't it? That if you're... Because you think, at this point in the book, she's basically been rescued from the horror of her home life. Her father has brought in a kind of... the strumpet from the trumpet to the local pub to come and basically to be his housekeeper. And what does Mrs. Churchill, the old housekeeper, be damned? She's a floozy. and there's brilliant scenes where they're eating, suddenly her father's eating all this fancy food
that you know, because Rosa, yes, the floozy, right, spring. So it's an awful, awful situation. And then she's had this terrible, you know, the guy from the waiter, who turns out not to be the head waiter from the hotel, but turns out to be the porter who rapes her, or almost rapes her. So she escapes down to look after her dull. What's his nickname?
Mr. Pebbles.
Blinkers. To look after the mother, who is this Miss Havisham, like,
who's the figure I was just
describing. I was just going to say this a little bit. This is just what she can do in a parrot. No one can tell me that this isn't really, really writing of the First Order. There's the old man and the chickens, right? And the man said, "They aren't good eaters, Cochins. The fat's in the wrong places. Look at that now." And he pointed to a bloated hen's body hanging from the shed. It was quite bare, except for a few feathers on its head, and between its relaxed beak there was one crystal bead of water. I looked at the pitiful and obscene sight and found myself thinking of Mrs. Peebles hanging in the barn. Mrs. Peebles had attempted suicide. But at least she was thin and had clothes on her body. I turned away but said good morning to the man, quite politely. After all, he was so used to hen's bodies, he didn't realise how depressing one could look, so fat and pale and gently swinging in the wind.
Oh, God! The thing is, we're laughing, but I don't think we're laughing because we think it's silly. It's so full of truth and
It's accurate. So remarkable. And so I know, Matt, you had a thing that you thought it got a little bit ripping yarns in places, that it was just, you know, there was just too much, you know. I mean, almost, you know, like Stella Gibbons, you know, shall I go and I'm going to go and kill, you know, there's hanging, yeah, and there's, yeah, the gothic elements. I didn't ever feel that she over...
It was the parrot in the downstairs lavatory pecking holes in the floor.
Yeah, picking its own feathers. I mean, you know...
A depressed parrot.
I mean, everybody.
Trapped animals. I mean, that's one of the things.
There's the thing about the black. But there's at one point when she says, you know, she's going home for the summer. She has to... The thing is, this is what's so brutal about the book. She gets out to Hailing Island, and she has this brief moment where there's Nicholas, who is the kind of beautiful boy that she goes skating with, and then she goes and watches him working on boats, and he's on leave from the Navy. So she has this sort of moment of, you know, for the first time she sort of knows what it's like to feel that attraction to somebody, because Blinkers, knows that Blinkers is a sweetheart, but he's really dull and has fat, hairy arms.
She's like bark, doesn't she? He looks like he's made of bark.
Oh, bark, I know. Oh.
He's so proud to be out with her.
She's so good on
her.
The fear.
That's one of the things I really loved about it, was that relationship with Blinkers. In that, so she's had this terrible relationship with her father, and he arrives as her saviour, but she immediately doesn't look at him as her saviour, which is, you know, a very realistic portrayal.
Well, exactly. I mean, real. You can't force yourself to fancy someone, can you?
I mean, nothing. Like I say, she's. You think she's escaped, and then she has to go back to that house. Yeah. She has to go back into the house. And she says, there's no summer. The only summer in the house would be the blackbird singing in the holly tree, which is the blackbird her mother.
And I will think, I will never look at holly trees again in the same way. Yeah. You know, that being at the start, you read that bit where it describes the dirty holly tree. Yes.
And what about the extraordinary bit where her mother suddenly starts talking about her childhood in Wales, which is one of the most... I mean, really heart-rendingly poignant.
That's amazing, that.
About how she grew up in this beautiful place.
Well, I think the book was supposedly, when Cumming started writing it, the mother was a central character and it was set in Wales. And then as she wrote, she realised that actually it was the story of the daughter instead, which I think accounts for such a long, sustained passage of the kind of the mother's life, basically.
Okay, that's interesting.
Because she came up to, I think she started writing... the vet's daughter, when she was on her honeymoon for her second marriage in Snowdonia, staying in Kim Philby's cottage.
Wow. I mean, she could have made the rural little fun, but she doesn't. She puts the most disgusting couple, the Gowleys.
Yeah.
So she never gets away from being spied. She's spied on through the book.
I think, I don't know what you think, Lucy, that is one of the brilliant elements of the book in terms of the way it contextualises the levitation. That the levitation is her only escape from this relentless parade of awfulness. And even that is co-opted. Even the rising up and escaping is controlled by other people.
Nothing breaks her, though. Nothing breaks her. You can't imagine having a more dreary, worse sort of life than this. But somehow she has this ability to literally to rise above it.
Yeah.
And you felt, when you hear about her life, she was a remarkable survivor.
So, Matthew, have you got anything tenuous to add?
Yeah. Some fatuous details.
Yeah. That's what we're hoping for.
That's what we're hoping for, always.
Yeah, so I've got a very fatuous detail, which is, you know that thing where people say, you've never heard of, like you did it to me earlier about someone, you talk about someone like, you've never heard of so-and-so, and particularly if you're interested in books, you get that all the time. You've never read? Well, in my house where I grew up, the book that my dad continually said, you've never read, and it was Neville Shoots on the Beach. It's like, you've never read Neville Shoots on the Beach? Which always, he always found that really remarkable. So the tenuous link this week is for my dad. It was a lovely dad. He wasn't an abusive vet.
With a moustache.
With a moustache. So my unabusive dad, who always said that to me, and Neville Shoots lived on Hailing Island, where they moved to in this book. How tenuous is that?
The author, Jenny Colgan, recently acquired a puppy for her family, and they've called that dog Neville Shoot. On the grounds that it will be spending a lot of time on the beach. Which is brilliant.
That is quite funny.
I've got a tenuous link this week.
Wow.
Excellent.
My tenuous link is that the vet's daughter, the most successful of Ms. Cummings' novels, I believe. Mm. I think that's her name. So it was turned into a radio adaptation.
Yes.
And a musical.
It was turned into a musical.
Well. Yeah.
It ran for... listen. It ran for a month. It was written by Sandy Wilson. Sandy Wilson, who wrote The Boyfriend. It ran for a month at the Marlowe Theatre in Canterbury, near where I live, in 1978. And here are a few of the musical numbers. Now, Matt doesn't let me... I love it when books are turned into musicals.
Right.
But on Backlisted, every time I try and get a song on, right, Matt refuses because he is prejudiced.
It's no more or less than that.
So here are some of the...
A musical bigot.
Yeah, he's a musical bigot. He knows. He's nodding. He's nodding along. So The Vet's Daughter was made into a musical called The Clapham Wonder. Here it is.
You wrote about this as well, didn't you? So just before you...
Yeah.
You wrote about this and it was very tragic about her.
Oh, so sad.
She wanted to hear
so
author from the audience.
I know. She wanted it to be successful and it was sort of, you know, and then there's a bit in her diary where she talks about how she's off to see the first night and she's so excited about it and she hopes that they'll be kind of screaming author for her. And then she gets there and it's this horrendous production that everyone is kind of obviously booing. And then she has to leave before it finishes to get the last train home. So she doesn't even see the ending of it. And she has to drink, like, a champagne, warm champagne out of a paper cup on the train home, knowing that...
The slowest train ever,
knowing that it's been a failure. And then I think the final line for that diary entry is, there's no hope, nothing to look forward to now, I'll never make any money. And it's so...
I'm not going to. I'm just saying because of Matt, you'll never get to hear My Little Tin Trunk and Me. You'll never get to hear Come for a Spin or The Strumpet from the Trumpet because of Matt's prejudice. I am sorry, everybody.
Is there an original cast recording?
Sadly, there isn't.
But this is Sandy Wilson. It's the boyfriend, the man who...
It should have been and could have been a hit.
I think they had high hopes and it just... Wow. I mean...
It's a pretty dark story.
Yeah. I wouldn't want the job of trying to dramatise this into a musical.
This is the music. This musical is the musical that Defying Gravity should have been written for.
Is there a song that accompanies the father selling puppies to the biggest extras?
Yes, a lot more to life than that.
That's brilliant.
Also, I've got one other thing. It's very quick to say. We have received some mild criticism here on Backlisted for selecting books that are out of print and are expensive to get hold of. And so I want to draw attention to listeners. There is currently an offer available from our friends at The Book People, online at The Book People,
brilliant,
where you can buy Sisters on a River, Our Spoons Came from Woolworths, and The Vet's Daughter, all three of those books for £4.99 for all three.
Bargain.
That is the best fiver you've
And in return for that massive plug for the book people, I am going to read you the blurb from their website. Imagine, I want you listeners to imagine that you buy Barbara Cummings' novels on the basis of this blurb compared with what we've talked about today. Here we go. Barbara Cummings was a very talented author who lived an extraordinary life and wrote a number of unique and witty novels that will keep fans of murder mysteries hooked. Maybe. The books are set in Victorian London.
Literally mouth.
And are heaving. And are heaving with quirky characters, strange events, love affairs, and mysteries to solve. And vivisection.
Mysteries to solve,
yeah.
Okay.
Just when you were reading that, just reminded me of that. Do you remember those brilliant characters that French and Saunders used to do? The old ladies who would they were very posh, and they'd lose a finger and
go to the dogs.
Go to the dogs. I sort of suddenly thought Barbara Cummings is one of those kind of. She must have been brilliant company, don't you think? She'd been through everything.
She reminded me of both Morwenna Banks's little girl character and Morwenna Banks's "Do I scare you? Are you attracted to me?" Yes. kind of weird
Absolutely.
Combination.
Just amazing. They don't make them like that anymore. That seems as good a point as any to start reading the script. Sorry. That seems as good a point as any to call it to a halt.
Thanks, Lucy, for coming on.
My pleasure entirely. It's been really nice to talk about her.
Oh, it's. I really hope.
Great.
Seriously, people, please, go to the book people or your library or
wherever.
Anywhere else you can get these books.
Whichever.
I feel like you can't. I mean, I know we've done a good job. Well, I think we have done a good job, but you can't quite. Grasp what she's like until you read her.
No,
so
absolutely
do.
Right.
Yeah.
It will. It'll be something you'll remember forever. I mean, it's a gift.
Thanks. So thanks, Lucy. Thanks, Matthew Clayton.
Thank you.
Thank you, producer Matt Hall.
Thank you.
Thanks once again to Unbound.
You can get in touch with us on Twitter @BatlistedPod, on Facebook, which is BatlistedPod, and on the page on the Unbound site, which is unbound.co.uk/backlisted. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with another show in a fortnight. Until then, it's good night from me.
Thanks, everybody. I'm going to break into song. Just for Matt now. Thanks. Bye-bye, everyone.
'If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole 2 extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.